So please do keep that open in front of you. That will be helpful. So that's Esther, chapter 2, 19 through to chapter 3, verse 15, to the end of the chapter there. Now imagine you wake up and you realize that you've overslept. Perhaps you forgot to set the alarm. Perhaps you were in such a daze that you turned off the alarm when it did go off and you've slept through. But either way, you are late. You jump out of bed. You're trying to run through in your mind what you need to prioritize to get ready in time and to get to work. No time, of course, to make breakfast. But as you get downstairs, what you find is that breakfast is waiting for you. You think, okay, well, do I have time to make lunch? You open the fridge and lunch is there ready for you in the fridge. You get into the car and you remember that you were next to empty when you parked up yesterday. And do you have time to go and get petrol? You turn the engine on and the petrol has been topped up already. You get into work just in time and you find that a generous colleague has already sorted out a cup of tea for you. A day like that might start in blind panic. All those obstacles, all those things that you've got to get through to get to the finish line. But it all gives way to relief if someone has had everything in hand from the very beginning. If someone has been there to help from the beginning. Now, it might seem strange, but that's the sort of thing that I think of when I think of the book of Esther. Generally, that's what I see as something of the theme running through. There is this mounting conflict. For those who lived through it, it must have seemed like everything was working against them. And it must have been a feeling in many of their hearts of blind panic. But though God isn't mentioned, he is there all the way through. He has it all in hand. Even before God's people know that there is a problem, know that there is a crisis, God is at work. And at the end, they can breathe a sigh of relief. Now, this is a lesson that applies to God's people still today. Some of the circumstances, of course, will have changed, but the ultimate lesson is still the same. God isn't less in control now than he was back then. He still has all things in hand, whatever the conflict that we're in might look like to us. That's at least part of the lesson then of Esther as a whole. But today's passage demonstrates it beautifully. You see, we're getting to the meat of the book now, where all the pieces have been placed, they've all been set, and the game has begun. Now we're going to tackle this passage where things start to happen. We're going to tackle this passage in an odd order. We're going to look at chapter 3 first, and then we'll think about the impact that chapter 2, that last bit of chapter 2, verses 19 to 23 has on where we're at in Esther as a whole. So we're going to look at chapter 3 first and then go back to chapter 2. And that's because in chapter 3 what we find is that we find the beginning of this conflict that marks this book. And what we see here when we look at the conflict is we see the heart of this conflict, kind of the origin of this conflict, what has caused it and what that teaches us for the conflict that we face today. And we also see not just the heart of this conflict, but we see the scale of this conflict too. So that's what we see in chapter 3, and then we'll go back to chapter 2. So our first point is the heart of conflict with the world, the heart of the conflict between God's people and the world. But as we think about that, let's first get our bearings, where we're up to so far. Esther, if we remember back to last week, Esther has been made queen. Mordecai has been able to be of service to the king. This is the king of Persia, the Persian Empire, greatest empire in the world at that time. And all things are going well for God's people, it seems. But then what we find in chapter 3 is that the bad guy comes onto the scene. This is the point where if it was a pantomime, you would have the boos and the hisses. Haman, the Agagite. Now we learn a couple of things about Haman. We learn lots about him as we go through the story, but even at the very beginning, we see him as an enemy of God's people, one who is bound to be in conflict with God's people. And that's because he is, we're told at least, that he is an Agagite. See, he is a descendant, it seems, of Agag, king of the Amalekites, against whom King Saul fought. You can read about that in 1 Samuel. And so this man is a descendant of enemies of God's people. And so it's as if he's there on the scene as a mark, as a picture of the conflict that God's people are bound to face. And this conflict that has been faced in the past is stirred up again and again and again in Esther's day. And it's a picture, really, then, of the conflict that God's people will always face in this world, even us today. So this Haman, we've learned a little bit about him. He is an enemy. And this enemy, or this one who will be an enemy, he is promoted in Persia. That's what we read. He is promoted to a position higher than pretty much all the rest, apart from the king. He even has a throne, we read in verse 1. And those who were once his peers now have to bow to him. All of them are bowing to him, all but one. Not Mordecai. Mordecai will not bow. He won't pay homage to him. Now, we don't know the exact reason that Mordecai won't bow to him. We don't know the exact reason for his refusal. Verse 4 seems to make some sort of link to Mordecai being a Jew. That might well have something to do with it. I think that's quite likely. And we can see here that Mordecai is now open about that fact. People know that he is a Jew. He has told Esther to keep that secret. But he is open about that here. And so it might be, if there is this link to his heritage and to his religion, the reason might be that he won't bow because there is a hint of worship in this bow that Haman is demanding, that the king has decreed. Perhaps Haman was so full of himself that he claimed to be some sort of divinity, that he had some spark of divine in him, and so people should bow down to him. But Mordecai, though there may have been some things that he has let go and he hasn't been completely faithful his life up to this point, some of the decisions that he's made, perhaps here he's drawing the line. He won't worship Haman. He won't worship a false god. Or it could be, if it's not something to do with worship, it could be that perhaps this bow is just the normal respect that you were expected to show to someone of a higher rank. But because Haman is an Agagite, and the history that there is, Mordecai sees it as too great a dishonor to him and his people to bow to him. I personally lean towards the first explanation. I think that's more possible, that he doesn't want to worship him. So Haman certainly has a very high opinion of himself. But either way, whatever one of those reasons it is, we see that Mordecai's refusal is used as the spark that sets off this conflict. Haman has advanced to the highest rank. It's as if he's finally got the promotion he's waiting for. He is on top of the world. And he's going through and he's seeing all of these people bowing down to him. This is what he's been waiting for. This is what he's wanted. Until he sees Mordecai. Till Mordecai comes along with all of his stubbornness. See, Mordecai recognizes authority, but not Haman's. He recognizes some other authority. And that seems to undo everything that Haman has been looking forward to. He's finally got to this position, but what's the point of it? There's no worth left to it if people like Haman can be so bold as to not bow down to me. And so Haman's bubble has been burst. Mordecai has spoiled it all for him. How dare he? And so Haman is filled with fury. That's what we read. He is filled with fury, and it is intense. He wants Mordecai dead. He wants him dead. He wants him to be killed, and not just him. As if that wasn't an overreaction in the first place. As if that wasn't extreme enough. He doesn't just want him dead. We read in verse 6 that Haman disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. It's as if he hated the idea that only Mordecai should suffer for this dishonor. He hated the idea, it seems, that any of Mordecai's friends or relatives or any of his people in any part of the kingdom should live, regardless of the fact that none of them have done anything to Haman. They don't know him. They're blissfully ignorant of all of these things that are going on, as many of them are back in Jerusalem or simply not in the king's court. They don't know him. Mordecai doesn't even know the vast, vast majority of them. He's only going to have a small circle of people that he actually knows. But that doesn't matter. Haman is furious. He wants them all dead, because then Haman would get what he wants. This obstacle will be removed finally, and he will get the respect that he deserves, the glory he desires. Mordecai is like a stone in Haman's shoe. It's like a smudge on the canvas. He's in the way, he's spoiling things. And this is part of the lesson that we can begin to learn as we look at this heart, this origin of this conflict between these two men. It shows us the kind of conflict that we as Christians can end up being in as we face the world around us. See, Christians today can still get in the way. They can be a problem. They can be a barrier to what people want today. And so the world can end up hating us. There can be conflict that arises because we just spoil things for those around us. You can see this in some quite specific areas in our society today. I saw a news article last week which I thought applied somewhat to this, even though it is very specific. I read that there's a US-Chinese team that have successfully made a human monkey chimera. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Basically, they've taken human DNA and they've inserted it into a monkey embryo, making a hybrid between the two. They've done similar things before with other animal embryos too. And for some, this is seen as great progress. There are opportunities that this opens up for medical advances. But in the eyes of others, this is going too far. Outrage has been expressed by some. Amongst those are plenty who are Christians in the medical field. They start to raise questions. Should we be doing this? What are the ethical issues? Is it a human? Does it have human rights? Does it not? Are we playing God? How far is it going to go? What's the next step? Where does it end? And that, along with objections to other ethical issues in medicine, can make those in the world frustrated with Christians, with Christian ethics. They get in the way. They stop this progress that we want. Another example from many years back now was when there was a lot of talk about fetal stem cell research. And the Superman actor Christopher Reeve was very vocal in his frustration at those who would block research in that area, at Christian groups from blocking research in fetal stem cells that he felt could perhaps lead to a cure for his own paralysis. Now, they had reasons for blocking that, for raising questions. It was blocked on religiously informed ethical grounds, but it got in the way. Christian priorities blocking the way to the world others want. Now, that's a very specific example in the medical field that might not be exactly and immediately relevant to where you are today, but there are other examples of this all around us. The obvious example that many are facing more and more are issues around sexual ethics and identity. There's very little in that realm, in this land at least, that Christians or traditional Judeo-Christian heritage now blocks. We don't block any of those things really anymore, do we? People generally sleep with whoever they want to sleep with, and they identify themselves however they want to identify themselves. That's all allowed now by law, but that's not enough. Christian ethics, for many, still seems to get in the way. It still frustrates, because some Christians don't celebrate along with everyone else. We don't necessarily have the same worldview as everyone else. And those two conflict and they grate against one another. They cause sparks. We don't endorse all choices that people make. We refuse to bow to where the culture seems to want to go. And so the bubble is burst. It annoys people, it frustrates people, and there is conflict with Christianity. Just as Mordecai didn't stop others from bowing down to Haman necessarily, he just didn't bow himself, but that wasn't good enough. And Haman, in his fury, plans to kill them all. And God's people still stand today as a reminder to the world that it isn't their world. They can't just do what they want. None of us can. We can't just look at this world and shape things however we want to. There is instead a higher authority. This is God's world. We stand as a reminder to that when we stand on what God's word says. And so in rebellion against God, they put themselves in conflict with God's people. And the scale of that conflict, as we see it growing, can be intimidating indeed. And so that's our second point, the scale of conflict with the world. So going back to this story with Haman and Mordecai, Haman is out for blood. And so he brings all of his resources to bear on this problem that he has to get rid of this smudge on the canvas, this stone in the shoe. What he does is he goes to the king. And in verse 8, we see him go to the king and he weaves this narrative to the king. He says, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them." You see, it's Haman's own pride that is wounded here, isn't it? But what he does is he goes to the king and he spins it as though it's an attack on the king's honor, on the authority of the king. And so he's getting the king on board by saying, "Look, I'm just trying to look out for your best interests. These people are a threat to your authority, king. They are disobedient. They follow their own laws." And Haman then not only takes this fear, perhaps, of the king, but he weaves in a financial thread as well, which is clever, as Xerxes or Ahasuerus. Well done, Leslie, for saying that name many, many times over. Let's just call him Xerxes. But he may have had financial issues at this point due to the war with Greece, which did not go particularly well at points. And so Haman comes to him and he says, "Well, these people, it's not to the king's profit to tolerate them. They won't make you profitable. They won't help you. You've got lots of problems as it is." And then he comes along and says, "Well, I can get rid of this problem for you, king." He offers a very generous financial contribution to this cause. 10,000 talents of his own silver. Now, I tried to figure out the price that much silver would get today. I looked at the footnotes and saw how much was in a talent in terms of weight, and then tried to look up the current price for a kilogram of silver and things like that. And if my math is correct, then it would be, today, if we had the same amount of silver, it would be worth over £200 million. I'm sure it would have been a lot more valuable back then as well. But either way, it's a crazy amount of money that he's willing to funnel in to this vendetta. He's putting everything into this. And he wants the king and all of his authority on board too, so that he can execute his plan. And the king agrees. Of course he does. This sounds great. He doesn't have to pay a penny out of his own pocket. And so they sit there, they plot their genocide, and they send messengers out to get things ready, to organize it. All of God's people in peril, even in Jerusalem, far away in Jerusalem, which was under Persian rule at the time. None then really would escape. And with their plans made, we read in verse 15 that Haman and the king, they sit down to drink. It's an interesting detail to add in, isn't it? They sit down to drink. They sit back and relax, celebrating their hideous work, their hideous plan, their callous disregard for life. And they're sure of their victory. That's what comes across, isn't it? He's got all this money, all this wealth. He's got the king's signet ring. He's got messengers who have gone out, and he can just sit back and enjoy a drink. Everything is stacked against God's people then. And to a degree, to a point, it can feel like that today. Of course, we're not in quite the same situation. I don't want to pretend that our lives today, here in the West particularly, is exactly like their situation back then. We're not facing imminent Christian genocide in the West, though our brothers and sisters elsewhere in the world do face dangers just like this. But generally speaking, we don't. But it can still feel that this theme is still at work in our lives. It can feel as though the odds are shifting, turning against us as we seek to be faithful to God and his word. Not just in the medical field, but in culture as a whole. We might hear of proposed bills in Parliament that would severely restrict the proclamation of God's word. Having looked at some of the things that have been proposed, it might make even something like this sermon illegal to proclaim, in some of its details at least. We might hear of restrictions that are placed on the choices of Christian business owners. There have been high profile cases of that, haven't there, in the past? We hear of or see narratives that come across in film or TV or music. We find that there are restrictions at times that are placed on social media platforms, and some Christians sometimes not justified, but sometimes they go to other social media platforms to try to escape censorship that they feel there are in some. Sometimes that's justified, sometimes that isn't. But it can feel like that sometimes, can't it? That there are these restrictions that are coming in from every angle. Certain agendas promoted in schools. And then, of course, we might feel that even amongst our friends, our family, our co-workers, our neighbors, there's conflict where there wasn't conflict before. The pressure, whilst not what it we have here in Esther chapter 3, still seems to be mounting. We can feel that. It can worry us. But as we look through the book of Esther, we find that there is most certainly hope. Whilst there is always conflict between God's people and the world, God will always have the victory. That's the theme of Esther, and so it's our third point. Certain victory in the conflict. This is where we go back to chapter 2, verses 19 to 23. And what we see there is that God is already at work. We know from last week's sermon that Esther is placed as queen, that peace is set. And what we read there at the end of chapter 2 is that Mordecai, because of where he was placed, outside the king's gate, he overhears a plot to kill the king. Mordecai reports it, the men are executed, the king is saved, and all of this is recorded in their books, in their chronicles. And so the king is indebted to God's people in many ways. He doesn't quite realize that yet. Perhaps God's people don't really realize that yet. But that's the state of affairs by the time we get to chapter 3. Whilst Haman makes his plans against God's people are already made safe by God. These things that have already happened here in chapter 2, this will change everything for the chapters to come. This is part of the means of their eventual rescue. But that's why the order is important, isn't it? We're focused on chapter 3 first, but of course chapter 2 comes before it. That's how numbers work. Mordecai's rescue of the king predates Haman's plot by years, and he didn't plan it. It's all set and ready for the rescue of God's people, but Mordecai didn't plan it. Mordecai didn't know it. He didn't know that Haman would come onto the scene at all. He didn't know. He didn't plan. He simply was faced with situations as they arose. He had to react to the situation that was presented to him. He had to react, but not God. See, God does not react. He doesn't need to. God doesn't need to adjust in a blind panic as he sees things going wrong, sees things going bad for his people. As he sees wicked plans made by evil men, he doesn't have to quickly adjust things. Now, God knows full well what the world will do, and yet he is still in control. And so his people, though they may go through difficult times, though they may go through times of panic and even suffering, even death, as we were thinking about this morning, even though they will face these things, God's people are ultimately safe right from the very beginning. So that's what we see here in these two chapters of Esther. But it's a hard one to apply, isn't it? See, we can see here as we read through the specific things that God put in place to protect Mordecai and the Jews from the bitter conflict that the world would bring. But that is a privileged position for us to be in. We see what God was doing then, but they didn't at the time. But because we can see it here as we read through Esther, often we can look at the conflict that we might be facing in the world and we can think, how can I find the same certainty of exactly what God is doing and see all of the bits put together? But we're not in that position. We are in the same position now with regards to our own day and age as they were to theirs. We don't know precisely what God's plans are for us, for our government, for our society, for our culture. It may get worse. It may get better for a time. But either way, it can all look very worrying as we look to the future. But that's why we have a book like this, so that we can learn the lessons of this book, to learn the lessons that Mordecai and Esther will learn by the very end, but try to apply them to the situation that we're in now. We need to learn the lessons that God isn't worried. God isn't surprised. God isn't panicked. God is certainly in control. His perfect plan is all in place already, and it is immovable. And his people are ultimately and eternally secure. Whatever we may face, we are eternally secure. Whatever the next few years may look like, we can all look with firm surety, knowing that we can look to Christ, that he will return. We don't know when that will be, but that time is set and his victory is secure. And his people, we are secure in him.